holy shit, it could happen here. It, in this case, being the podcast that you're listening to, and in fact, it is happening here in your ears. But you know what else is happening here? The world's kind of fallen apart. Well, I don't know, not the world, but the structures in the world that we all relied upon for, you know, existence and shit sure are crumbling. Anyway, I'm Robert Evans. This is a podcast about how things are falling apart and how to deal with that shit. If you're new to the show, maybe check out our first 5 episodes. They'll catch you up. They're evergreen. But this week, we have a special guest and a special conversation to have that I think is going to be edifying for a lot of people. I would like to introduce Mr. Joey Ayoub. Joey, you are a writer and a researcher and the host of The Fire These Times, which is a fantastic podcast.
Thank you.
Joey, how are you doing today?
I'm fine. I'm operating within Norman parameters, as I said before.
Yeah, I'm impressed by that because I'm constantly in the process of falling apart, which mm-hmm. is why I was late to this call. Joey, you want to give our listeners a little background on yourself?
Sure. I'm originally from Lebanon. That's where I grew up. My family's kind of mixed, bit of Palestinians, bit of Italians, bit of Argentinians, kind of all over the place. And I'm currently in Switzerland, continuing my PhD, which one day will actually be done. I hope. I have been told that there is a life after the PhD.
Yeah.
So that's what I do. And I do podcasts and I write and I stuff that I probably forgot.
And you wrote a column that I quite admire for a website called Lausanne, which was based on a term that I think it was the Mengal media folks came up with, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that term is the periphery. And one of the reasons I think this is useful, so when I grew up, and I suspect it was the same, I don't know if it was the same for Garrison because he grew up in a weird cult, but it was probably the same for Christopher. The terms we heard a lot for different, like it was either basically the United States or Europe, or it was the third world, right? Those were the terms that I grew mm-hmm. up with. And I wasn't, I was like probably 17 or 18 before I actually learned that the terms first and third world kind of came from the Cold War, where like the U.S. is the first world, the Soviet bloc is kind of the second world, and then everyone else mm-hmm. is the third world. Obviously, that's not a great collective noun for referring to any group of anything. We try not to use third world, and a new term has kind of become more, I don't know, vogue may be the wrong word, but people have started using the global south to refer to everywhere that's not the U.S. and Europe and, you know, a handful of other countries, and kind of that's not great either, because for one thing, a lot of those countries aren't south.
And Australia isn't north either. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm interested in this because there is a use in having kind of collective nouns to refer to groups of people from multiple nations, and, mm-hmm. and the West isn't going to do for most places. And I like this term, the periphery, because kind of the way that you and the Mengal folks kind of have described it makes a tremendous amount of sense to me. And it makes a tremendous amount of sense because it's not trying to group people together based on their relationship to a Western-centered kind of like international power dynamics understanding that even a lot of people on the left here kind of fall into where, you know, mm-hmm. You're either a imperialist or anti-imperialist, but being anti-imperialist means supporting a lot of imperialist powers because they're against whatever imperialist power you were born into. Anyway, I wonder if we could start by kind of getting your explanation of what is the periphery, and how do you
sure,
see
yeah.
that? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so I'll just say like up front that I don't expect that term to work every time and in all mm-hmm. contexts. For example, I know someone who like works in development studies and who we had a pretty informative chat about the terms Global South and Global North, and she was pretty convincing that they can be useful in a certain like in a materialist analysis of certain things. So I'm not kind of here to say like it doesn't work ever, basically. But I think what really clicked with me, or there are a number of things that really clicked with me, and one is that conversation with F.A. Levant on Mangan Media on their own podcast as well. I've written for them, and then we had a chat about, it was like about the explosion in Beirut last year. And at some point, the topic of the periphery, which they coined, I didn't coin it, came about. And the best way he described it, which is a bit ironic given the podcast I'm on now, is that when anti-authoritarian Turks, he's from Turkey, see protests in, for example, Lebanon or Hong Kong, which was what they were happening at the same time in 2019, and Iraq and other places, Chile and so on, they sort of think that it could happen here. Like, you know, it could happen in Turkey, essentially, mm-hmm. which is not the case often with like French leftists or American leftists, or yeah. usually leftists that are broadly speaking in the West. Now, there are obviously exceptions to all of these rules. Not every Turkish leftist thinks like that. Not every Western leftist thinks like that. But it's kind of a general trend. And for me, for example, the way I can explain it is that a podcast like It Could Happen Here, where you're sort of describing a situation that might happen here in America, let's say, wouldn't necessarily be needed in, for example, Lebanon, because it's already happening. Yeah. And it's been happening for some time now.
Yeah.
And that tension, in some sense, when I would, because now I live in Switzerland, so I'm in you know, in Geneva, which is as international as at the center in some sense as it gets almost. This tension between my daily life essentially here and what's happening back home on a daily basis is what has sort of led me to think about this other term, the periphery, because I just felt that at least on an emotional level, Global South wasn't working as well, if that makes sense.
And one of the things I really find so useful and admirable about this term is that it's a collective noun for referring to a group of people, but it separates those people from the mm-hmm. state, from their government. Yes. So when you're talking about the periphery, and you include people from Lebanon, people from Palestine, people from Syria, you're not including the governments. It's not the states. It's the because the people are peripheral to the power of those states and to the blocks that those states find themselves in, which is why they, you know, any efforts at autonomy on the communal level are crushed so violently.
That's why, like, for me, Global South, the term includes the states from the so-called Global South that are crushing the activists from the so-called Global South. And so it just felt that I just needed this other layer, this other term that explains that dynamic as well.
Yeah. You know, one of the things you just were talking about was kind of the way in which a lot of leftists in the United States and chunks of the West will kind of disregard liberatory struggles overseas that don't neatly fit into a very simple ideological category. I'm kind of wondering, as, you know, a kid who grew up in Lebanon and kind of, I'm going to assume, mostly focused on the regional kind of politics, when did you start to realize that was something that was going on internationally? Like, when did you realize, kind of, like, you know, I think a lot of folks were taken surprise by the reaction of a lot of the international left to, like, the Arab Spring. And I'm kind of wondering, was that mm-hmm. when it kind of hit home for you, or did you start to see stirrings of those problems at an earlier date?
2011 is when it kind of became very concrete in some sense. But I grew up having to visit Switzerland, actually, because my dad is a Swiss national. And I would do so on the Lebanese passport, obviously. So I would always need to apply for visas beforehand and so on, you know, like 2 or 3 times a year sometimes. And that sort of, in retrospect, it was those early experiences, just meeting the border, just experiencing a border all the time. That's sort of, I think, anyway, it's one of those things that I've been thinking, like, in retrospect, like, planted the seeds of what was to come, if that makes sense. Because I was always peripheral whenever I would go to Switzerland. I was never allowed to stay there longer than, let's say, 3 weeks if they gave me 3 weeks, or 3 months if they gave me 3 months. And it sort of felt weird coming to Europe all the time, because I'm actually born in France, but I don't have the citizenship. And so there was this sense that I felt it weird having to ask permission from someone to go to the place where I literally started my existence.
Yeah.
And so from on a very basic level, that's never quite always, like, squared with me. And that, like, led to a number of things that from Lebanon, I was seeing the rest of the world in that sense. And it took me some time. I think after the Arab Spring, especially when I started seeing that Lebanon is peripheral, although I didn't really have a term for that before. And the quote unquote real things were happening in the West. Now, obviously, that's all problematic, and I don't mean that literally, because real things are happening everywhere all the time, but in the sense of what gets to matter, whose lives get to matter more, and so on and so forth.
Now, one of the things I think about a lot when I read your work, and when I consume what Mangal Media puts out. Mangal Media is, I guess you'd call it a journalistic collective.
Yeah.
made up of people. A lot, I think a lot of them were or are have worked as like fixers in you know, the periphery and parts of the Middle East. And they're, what I find so vital about their voices is that it was, as an American journalist who's worked over there, it was always those folks who had the best stories. It's just that those stories got published with the New York Times or with the New Yorker or the Washington Post under somebody else's byline, right? That's the way journalism actually works. In these, you do have some reporters like I'm spacing on his name, but the fellow who wrote "No Good Men Among the Living," who
Anand Gopal.
Yes, who has done? I mean, I think just I'm sure has local sources in Afghanistan, but also speaks the language and is just an accept. But for the most part, especially when you see somebody with my complexion reporting from over there, if they're getting good shit, it's because of a local. And what I like about Mangal is that it breaks down kind of that barrier between that kind of white person filter between the actual people living on the ground and understanding the situation and the person who's trying to package it. Which is not to say that I think there's no value in having a local package. And I think anytime you're trying to translate a story across, there is some reason for that. But I also think it leads to, I mean, I know it leads to problematic kind of American, there's a lot of problems that it leads to. We don't have enough time to discuss all of them.
Yeah.
But what I'd like to talk about with you is kind of how as consumers of media in the United States and in the West, which most people listening to this are, everyone on this call but you was born in the U.S. or a place that is the same as the U.S. but with a better hat. I'm talking about Canada. so how do you recommend if we aspire to be internationalists and to avoid falling into that trap of flattening the struggles of other people to fit inside of a simple ideological rubric, how do you recommend people try and cut out or minimize to the extent possible the bias of whatever region they live in when reading news from another part of the world? Like, how do you do that?
Well, imperfectly, right? Like, it's never going to be, it's never going to be, you know, there's always going to be flaws. There's always going to be a learning curve to all of that as well. One thing that's worked for me, because, you know, I did grow up in Lebanon, and so there is that dimension, but I had a pretty sheltered childhood, you know, media was mostly on the internet, and so I could kind of go wherever I want. And I was pretty isolated, up until a certain point, I was pretty, let's say, sheltered from what was happening even around Lebanon, up until, let's say, just before the Arab Spring. So I do know what it's like to kind of have biases against, you know, other places and have certain, it's just human flaws at the end of the day. The main difference, I think, is just what gets centered and what gets peripheral. I mean, just to use that same term again. One thing that I've been doing to kind of help myself, and so I'll just speak from personal experience, is go to some websites like Lausanne. I read Lausanne regularly, Mangal Media as well, and there are a number of other websites that are trying as much as they can to actually write for one another. Like, they're actually trying to write with the assumption that most people who are going to read are not from the West. And that's not easy to do for language barriers, for example. If they're mostly writing in English because the diasporas of the world, if there is some sense in kind of connecting to one another, we're probably going to do it in English. I'm just realistically speaking.
Yeah.
And so maybe Spanish, but, like, you know, probably English. And that's something that we have to sort of contend with. It's not easy because it could be that I can spend all of my time having conversations with, let's say, other people in the diasporas of other groups, let's say. And because I'm doing it entirely in English, then I'm actually not conversing with people back home. And so that creates another problem. And there's no easy solution, basically. I don't really have a solution that can fit any scenario. So I don't really have a good answer to that, actually. I just think that reading diverse sources is the best way to do things, but with a critical eye as well. Although I feel like that's kind of a boring answer. And for me, the thing that has been quite refreshing is seeing projects like Lausanne, which is why I've published like an interview with, like, we did an interview conversation thing where we were exploring parallels and contrasts between Hong Kong and Lebanon, for example. And that for me was a piece where I was entirely thinking about the people I was talking to, like people from Hong Kong, and that's it. We had a diaspora experience in common, but I wasn't thinking, and we were speaking in English, but I wasn't thinking about how is this going to be received in New York or Paris or London or whatever, right? And I feel like these, more of these probably will help because it centers different voices rather than the ones that we're used to. But even though it's center, I'm sort of saying it with like an asterisk, because my entire point is that I'm actually uncomfortable with certain situations where I risk being the center of a story when there are so many things happening to my periphery as well. And yeah, so it can happen on different layers, if is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the problem of being, as you are, kind of a child of two worlds, where you have mm-hmm. the benefit of it makes it easier to explain both places to the other. But you also, you have a wall, kind of, or at least a couple of them up inside you, which exactly. is yeah, and it is like there's no kind of gaining perfect perspective on any place, including the place where you live. But I do think it's important to talk about kind of at least decentering to the extent that's possible, like Western voices when we're trying to understand places that are not Western. So I think one of the things I've talked with you a fair amount just via chats over the years, particularly during some of the nonsense last year, is internationalism, which is a real concern, mm-hmm. I think, of everybody on this show, and something that used to be in a lot stronger state than it is in the left. What do you see as the primary barriers to functional internationalism at the moment?
Well, West centrism is, I think, a primary one. Racism, Islamophobia are pretty common as well. Islamophobia is a pretty massive one, to the point that, like, even non-Muslims like me can be swiped, can kind of just taken with it as well. And I just think that when I say West centrism, I don't even only mean people who are from the West and are thinking about the West as the center of the world. But I also mean like leftists from other parts of the world that think that the only enemy is the West, or the only enemy is America, for example. And, you know, Christopher and I had chats about this as well on my own podcast, actually, about the Tiananmen, the legacy of Tiananmen as well, right? Like, it's not just misunderstood misunderstood among, let's say, white Americans, but it could also be misunderstood among Chinese Americans, for example. There are these multiple layers in which something can be misunderstood on different layers as well, if that makes sense. And for me, the problem with West centrism is that it takes up so much oxygen in the room. It just takes up people like me and others, and like I've met folks from like the Balkans and the Middle East and Southeast Asia, and like on almost any group I can think of, I've met them that have complained about pretty much the same thing, that they ended up spending so much time on the internet debunking disinformation, or debunking tankies, or debunking campism, or debunking what have you, or just misinformation sometimes. And this ends up being pretty exhausting. Like, this ends up being like shit is happening on the ground. Like, things are actually happening on the ground, and activists from, let's say, Beirut, or that didn't happen as much in Beirut, but, you know, from Iraq or Syria especially, obviously, but Hong Kong as well. You know, they have to deal with concrete problems on the ground, but at the same time, they have to worry about how this is being perceived on the internet, because usually it's assumed that how it's perceived on the internet, so especially in the Anglophone online mediascape, can have real life consequences on the ground. And this is something that is very difficult to tackle, because it's not enough to just fight them by having more Laosans and more Mongol media. For one, we just don't have the resources to challenge a Fox News or a CNN or what have you. And for two, it's just exhausting. I think the main thing that has stopped most activists I can think of, or at least they've taken a break or what have you, is just burnout more than anything. It's not even, in many cases, obviously, it's also direct threats from the state and stuff like that. But more often than not, it's just being exhausted from having to spend so much time dealing with what's happening on the ground, while at the same time making sure that what's happening on the ground isn't being misinterpreted, or, you know, having to deal with disinformation or what have you. And so basically the responsibility ends up being on people consuming these kinds of media. And I don't want to make it too individualistic either. There are structural problems to these things, as I said, CNN, the resources, all of that. But given that I can't, like, CNN is not going to listen to me, the next best thing is trying to just speak to just people who are willing to listen, essentially.
And you talked a bit about, I mean, the situation in Lebanon right now. If people aren't aware, there was a massive explosion a year or so ago. Mm-hmm. And everything's kind of been in free fall since. And what's happening in Beirut and across, like, there have been massive wildfires that have destroyed a huge chunk of the country's forests. And a lot, like, just kind of society seems to be breaking down in a lot of areas. There's mm-hmm. stores don't have food. People don't, like, the inflation has reached kind of a nightmarish level. What do you, like, we're talking about, you know, these are all kind of the same problems that we're talking about everywhere. It's just it's much more severe at the moment there, and it's in a much more advanced state for a variety of reasons. Do you have any hope for mitigation? How could the situation improve, I guess? Like, I'm looking at Lebanon, and I'm thinking about, like, what, not even like what I could do, because I don't think there's anything I can do, but like how things could possibly get better. And
yeah,
I'm wondering if that's any clearer to you.
Maybe only slightly more, but
yeah,
it's really bad. I mean, crumbling, you know, welcome to the crumbles that actually fits the what's been happening for at least a couple of years, if not a bit more than that, pretty well. There is a mass exodus happening on a slow, depending on the seasons, basically. Sometimes it's faster in summer and then whatever. But basically, most of my friends, for example, like 90% of them are now abroad. And there is definitely a sense of collapse. That's, you know, in here is the term that we would use. It just feels like a state of collapse, essentially. And what's kind of interesting, I think, is that this was being predicted for some time now. It's been a couple of years. I would say, I mean, towards the end of 2019 with the revolution, not that long after, you already had a lot of people within Lebanon, like, kind of, you might call it the initial phases of counter-revolution in some sense, although that's probably a bit simplistic, but basically saying that if we continue taking to the streets, the country is going to collapse. And that's obviously not the reason the country is going to collapse. The reason that is collapsing, the reason is a combination of COVID, last year's port explosion, corruption in the state, sectarianism, warlords basically controlling most of the country, and so on and so forth. As for what can happen next, I mean, it does seem that at least for the foreseeable future, it's going to continue more or less the way it's been continuing. It feels like basically a decline that's sometimes steeper and sometimes less steep. The stories on a daily basis are, like, you know, a friend took her like 5 hours to fill up gas, and it's not even, she can't, you know, fill the entire tank, and electricity went out for like 3 days. And so people, you know, their fridge was useless, you know, stuff like that. And it is definitely, I don't have the percentage with me, and those are just data, and data without stories are, can be misleading as well. But something like 70%, I'm going to say, of the population is below the poverty line now compared to before, stuff like
Jesus.
That. So it's pretty dire, and it happened at such a speed that I'm going to say that I haven't been back since January 2020 for various reasons, COVID and security threats and other stuff.
Sure.
And I can't quite picture it in my mind. It's not that easy, but friends, obviously, speaking to them and photos and videos that I see, it's just fair to say that everything that I can think of, or most things that I can think of from before 2019, basically most of my life, is essentially gone. And there is no way of getting over that quickly, if that makes sense. And you'll probably never get over it anyway, but you might get to some point where you kind of regain enough energy to actually maybe act on it, if that makes sense. But there is a period in which now people are basically still grieving. And they're still grieving from last year's explosion as well, because there's still no investigation, the usual stuff. And so, it's grim, and it's going to be grim for some time, I think. That being said, I don't think that people back home, you know, aren't doing anything. They are. You have a number of initiatives. You have a number of basically mutual aid societies, although no one really calls them that, but they just pop up on their own. And these things function to a certain extent. Often they don't last too long, usually due to resources or burnout or what have you. And so Lebanon is one of those things. I had this, I think it was after the explosion last year as well. I was on another podcast, The Arts of Travel is called, I think it was on that one, where he basically said that he thinks that for him, the apocalypse looks like what happened in Lebanon. And I think I know what he meant, but the problem with that analysis is that often we think that the apocalypse just happens and then that's it. But there's most of the story is actually the day after, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And in Lebanon, as it happens, the apocalypse looked apocalyptic. You know, that one day, that explosion that took just a few seconds and it destroyed so much of the capital and beyond. But the real story is what's been happening since then. And there, I think, is where Lebanon does have lessons, well, for Lebanon first and foremost, but also for the rest of the world.
You know, I think we're all kind of in this position of watching the place, seeing the place, most of us at least, seeing the places where we live in stages, you know, and mostly at the moment in earlier stages of what Lebanon's going through, not as severe, but also kind of inevitably approaching that, right? I think most, you know, I have a couple of friends who are school teachers who are like just kind of going to work with the absolute certainty that a bunch of people are going to get infected in the very near future. I have people who work at hospitals that are no longer able to handle basic medical procedures for a lot of people that are triaging care. You know, that just came out that Idaho is going to have to start triaging like medical care based on who they think might be able to survive.
Italy did that last year as well.
Yeah. We're all living through stages of that. And the overwhelming question is like, how do we pull out of the tailspin? And this is, you know, not a question I expect us to have. I've put it forward, and I think sometimes online people are like, oh, you know, it's naive to think that like, you know, a general strike or mutual aid could avert the tailspin. And I don't think those are complete solutions to pulling out of the tailspin. I know there are aspects of what the solution will be. Nobody knows what the solution is because we're still in a tailspin. In your mind, what do you think might be part of that answer with the knowledge that, and please, people on Reddit, nobody's saying this is the complete solution to the problem, but like I'm hoping by gathering people together who think about stuff, we can arrive at aspects of it.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's a combo. So in my own personal experience, basically what I can speak of to the most, it's a combo of reaching out to people in similar situations. So in my case, diasporas especially. But like more broadly, for me, I think it has to be a combination of pragmaticism. So I do believe in lesser evilism, for example, when that's the only option. Sometimes I feel like I need to choose and that's the only option I have. And so I do that. At the same time, doing so without the, you know, so Biden versus Trump, to use that simple example. But at the same time, knowing that that's not going to change much, if anything, it might slow the collapse down. And that's actually the metaphor that I prefer to think about. Like slowing things down gives me time to do other things, if that makes sense. So it gives me time to do more things rather than always having to defend myself constantly. The other, like more broadly, I think it's a combination of trying to build dual power, trying to build mutual aid as much as possible. This is not going to solve things, but I just don't think there is anything that's going to solve everything. I don't see how that's going to be possible. And the lack of that is what I think many people, it's scary. I mean, it's scary, right? It just scares a number of people. It scares most people. I mean, it scares me as well. And I do understand then the instinct to sort of go towards, well, you know, we have the EU, we have the US, we have those grand structures, and we're going to just try and reform them and change them and so on and so forth. I understand that. And I don't judge people who believe that and who genuinely think that they can change things. You know, I wish them good luck, basically. If they succeed, good for everyone, right? It's just that I think due to structural factors, primarily due to related to power and how power corrupts in almost every single case I can think of, and pretty much all of them, I just don't think these are solutions either. And I view my role as trying and be critical as much as I can, trying to be honest as much as I can, saying when I just don't know something, then I just don't know something. and having a healthier balance on how to deal with this. But that being said, I don't have the answer. I don't have the I think it is like 90 episodes on my podcast now, and there are a number of episodes in which this topic comes up, and some people have some answer, some people don't have an answer, and just becomes an open question. But I would hope that at least the fact that there are no clear answers doesn't discourage people from at least trying to find these answers. Because I do think most of the time the solution is going to be found while attempting to solve something else, if that makes sense. It's the act in itself, or the acts in themselves, that are going to produce some of these solutions, because most of these solutions don't exist yet. We have to literally create them from scratch often.
Yeah. I think that's an important thing to accept, that in a lot of cases, you know, we don't know how to fix the problem. I think the people who claim that it's whatever book they read, written 100 years ago has the perfect solution, I tend to think that's pretty arrogant. But mm-hmm. I do think that what's not arrogant is like getting your hands dirty and trying to fix problems and hoping and understanding that kind of the solutions to broader problems will come in part through dealing with and trying to improve the situation on a day-to-day basis. You know, we just did an episode about self-managed abortion, where the, mm-hmm. the source was definitely more on the liberal end of things than the left end of things. And somebody who politically I would probably have a lot of disagreements with, but she spent the last 25 years trying to train communities of people to provide to take control of reproductive health and like enable other members of their communities to take direct control of that. And that is something I very much believe in. And I think that's like, that's, mm-hmm. that's part of the solution, right? Part of the solution to why the fucking coronavirus has gotten so goddamn out of hand is everything to do with our broken healthcare system. And it's not just the fact that healthcare is expensive. It's the fact that people are kind of alienated from an understanding of their bodies. They're not properly educated about the way things work, and they don't feel like they have that kind of the consistent lack of a feeling of like medical autonomy leads people eventually to embrace nonsense. And so
yeah.
There you have, and kind of this very focused solution to one really specific problem, a part of, I think, a larger solution to the problems that confront us. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. And, you know, I mean, speaking of COVID, I think that, we know that part of the reasons why it's lasting so long as well, other than local dynamics within a nation, is that richer nations are basically holding the vaccines at this point. Already talking about like the third booster shot in Switzerland, for example, and most of the world still doesn't have the first one. Those are political decisions. Those are political decisions being made on behalf of the rest of the world, as we see with climate change as well. It's the same story.
Yeah. I don't know what to do about that at this stage. Like, it seems like kind of at every level we've given up on handling this the right way. You know, the clear best solution would have been to treat the rollout of the vaccine, you know, the same way we treated World War II, as like a logistical hurdle on par with getting a couple of million of men to Western Europe. And we do that to get the vaccine to everybody so we could have hopefully fucking stopped the variants from hitting. But we didn't do that, and we're not going to do that. And so I guess we're all left with mitigation once again, which is often the story with climate change too. And I don't know. We've already kind of trod on that territory. Garrison, Christopher, is there anything you wanted to get into before we close out?
Yeah, well, I think one thing specifically with COVID that I think is really interesting is if you look at the places where COVID, like, you know, was bad, but like didn't, you know, kill 600,000 people, you know, particularly looking at China and Hong Kong with this. So, you know, China, both the government of China and the government of Hong Kong's initial state response is really bad. And what happened was, you know, in China, it's sort of, you know, you have a bunch of people who don't trust the government, and so what they do is you get hundreds of thousands of people sort of just mobilizing and forming these sort of volunteer things to enforce lockdowns, to enforce restrictions, to give people food. And, you know, it's part of some of it's state-backed, some of it's not, and some of it's, you know, you get this sort of hazy line between the sort of mass mobilization and between just people doing stuff on sort of state-aligned directives. And then in Hong Kong, you know, and people like torch border crossings, people like, you know, there's this huge thing to get everyone masked. There's this huge, like, and then this stuff is like entirely against the sort of government. But what I think is interesting about both of them is that it's like, you know, it turned out to be possible to make the pandemic less bad if you mobilized. And it wasn't really the state that did this. It was, you know, people who didn't really trust the state and were like, okay, so we're going to take this into our own hands. And I think, you know, in some ways, like that seems like the thing that can be done is you have to get people moving first, like before everything completely collapses. I guess something I also think was interesting about that was that the way that, and I think this going back to the internationalism part we were talking about, is that there's this way in which that is particularly in China, the story of this hundreds of thousands of people doing these mass mobilizations just never reached the West at all. Like, it, you know, everyone looked at China and went, oh, this is how the state is reacting. And it's like, yeah, the state did a lot of extremely weird things. Some of them were good, some of them were bad. But the sort of mass popular mobilization beneath it gets erased. And I think, and I'm wondering what you think about this, Joey, looking at even how the left worked in the 90s, or looking at the Zapatistas and looking at the People's Global Assembly stuff that they set up, on how that stuff was about social movements. It wasn't about states. It wasn't about necessarily political parties. It was, you know, you'd bring a bunch of social movements together. And I'm wondering what you think about the extent to which part of what went really wrong in the left in the last 10 years is that they abandoned that, and it became sort of, everything became, like, internationalism became almost completely state and party based.
Yeah. I mean, for me, the Arab Spring is where, I mean, this is, I mean, it might sound a bit of an exaggeration, but it's where the left sort of buried itself. Like, for me, it's like, I still broadly call myself on the left just because it's simpler, but I have a lot of problems with a lot of people who are on the left when it comes to so many different things. I don't quite know where it started. Some people trace it back to, like, the, you know, I don't know, like the Hungarian Revolution in 1956, you know, stuff like that. So I don't quite know where you start or where you ended, but it does seem that at some point, it's a combination of the hauntings from the Balkan Wars and the genocides there, and the denialism that was allowed to essentially be just grow and be normalized to the point that some guy, like, last year or 2 years ago, he got the Nobel Prize for Literature, even though he's a Bosnian genocide denier. And just these things are becoming, have become in the past decade or two, I suppose, more normalized. And now we're sort of back to the mitigation section of things. For me, the Arab Spring, and to use the metaphor of the canary in the coal mine, was sort of that. But I'm sure you can go further back, and some people will say it actually started with Bosnia or Rwanda or something. But I wouldn't say that. I can say, like, for certain where it started, if that makes sense. But yeah, for me, it's obviously the Arab Spring. That's been the center of my world for a long time now, and it's where I felt that the lack of support that was needed. And it's ongoing. I'm talking about it in the past tense, but it's ongoing. Yeah. Like, Daraa is being bombed right now.
Yeah, they just bombed Idlib too, right?
Yeah. So, you know, it's ongoing. The humiliation is ongoing. The Assad regime is putting out the green buses, which every Syrian knows what they're about. The humiliation ones where you escort people out of their homes, basically. And they know. Like, the regimes, I think, at this point, know what they can do and what they can't do. They're pretty confident in what they can and can't do. So, yeah, sorry, I'm ending another pretty positive note on that, unfortunately.
Yeah. But yeah. I don't know, man. I guess as a last question, I'm kind of curious. Yeah. You've analyzed the problem of the left kind of aligning themselves with parties and with nations, and how that leads to a tremendous amount of blind spots, a flattening of conflicts, and a flattening of the humanity of people who don't live close to you. Which is, you know, all part of the problems that we are in right now. What do you think we ought to be aligning ourselves around? Like, if you're getting, you know, if we can come to see ourselves as all in the periphery, and in the periphery, at least in sort of as relates to these states, because in a way we all are, right? People in the United States certainly like benefit more from imperialism and from the might of the United States, but we're also peripheral to the power of that state, which I think a lot of people may have experienced for the first time when they got tear gassed last year, or as kind of the different state effects or attempts to deal with the coronavirus have failed disastrously. But what should we be aligning ourselves around? Like,
even the example that you gave is, for me, it's a pretty good one, because that's also sort of the point that, like, centers and peripheries are everywhere, and they're also within nation states. So like, Lebanon is peripheral to America, but many Americans are peripheral to other Americans, if that makes sense, and to other Americans in power, especially. Like, for me, one of the primary thinkers behind my own thinking is James Baldwin, you know, African American. So like, he is technically a Westerner, but I would consider a lot of his writing to be peripheral, essentially. And that's because he has this amazing quote that I'm going to probably butcher, but it's something along the lines of like, the oppressed don't only know the oppressors better than the oppressors know the oppressed, but they also know them better than they know themselves. That they, like, the oppressed know the oppressors better than the oppressors know the oppressors, essentially. Which is, I think Fanon said something similar as well. And for me, this is a sort of insight. This is kind of the thing that blew my mind. And this is this thing that I would say in the past few years have really shaped everything. As to what to sort of like ally ourselves with, I mean, the problem is that it sounds very cheesy to say to have actual principles and maintain them. But the problem is that we don't do it often. We don't actually maintain these principles often enough. I don't know if I'm not going to speak for everyone, obviously, but in my experience, it is difficult to maintain them. And often what I see is very seasoned activists basically dealing with burnout and kind of retiring from public life and from activism and just kind of doing their own thing and whatnot. And for me, the question is, how do I continue doing what I'm doing, but in the long term? And there is a time component to this. There is a resource component to this. And the more we are able to add these different frameworks to understand things with, like, for me, the periphery is just one framework. You know, feminism is another one. Anarchism is another one. None of these things explain everything all the time, right? But it's just different lenses from which I can understand the world. And my advice, which is not an easy one, I still struggle with it, is to just try and have as many different lenses as possible. And that's sort of my advice. It's not a very quotable one. You're not going to find this on a t-shirt, I think.
Well, Joey, that's I think all I had to ask and get into today. Did you have anything else you wanted to talk about before we roll out and leave our audience to, I don't know, go grow some cabbage or whatever?
Well, growing cabbage in community is always the best thing to do, to be honest.
Make food.
Make food. Do community gardens. That's the best thing anyone can do, to be honest. I don't know. No, I can talk about solarpunk. I can talk about a bunch of stuff. But I guess my advice to everyone would be grow a bunch of veggies for everyone all the time.
We'll have a more, I had been meaning to include a lot more solar punk stuff in the first five episodes of this. We got a bit at the end, but it's, I want to do a more detailed, and meaningful exploration. So we'll have you back for that. But, Joey, sure. I thank you so much for coming on, your podcast, The Fire This Time. Fire These Times. Sorry. And, also no check worries. Out Mengal Media. And Lausanne, you've written for both places, and also both great sources for people to check out if you want to de-westify your reading about other parts of the world. All right, that's going to do it for us here at It Could Happen Here. Until it does, like Joey said, start a fucking garden.